In my old age, I've decided that the only way that, I used to think that when you give talks, you're supposed to give this long introduction and blah blah, and then I realize everyone just falls asleep at the end of that. So, so I'm going to go straight to the punchline. And then I'll explain everything on this slide. Everything on the slide by the end. So if you stay awake, you get it all. If you don't, well, okay, you get the punchline, you don't understand it. These folks, well, I'll tell you exactly what their names are, BDRS, 2 years ago developed a new method using jet substructure to demonstrate that the Higgs to BB bar mode at low Higgs masses, 120 plus or minus a little bit, low Higgs masses of the standard model Higgs could be discovered at the LHC with a significance of, in the neighborhood of 4 to 6, depending on details, with 30 inverse femtobarns of data. This is a 14 TeV collider. This is their plot. I didn't do the plot. I don't know all the details of the plot. What you're supposed to get from the plot is there's a bunch of backgrounds. There is a Z peak, and there is a Higgs peak, and they are well separated. Okay. This is the first new piece of Higgs physics, qualitatively new piece of Higgs physics that's come out in the past decade, I would say. Yeah. Remarkable technique now being applied to a number of different methods and areas. Interestingly, Higgses that go to BB bar are not just in the standard model. Supersymmetry also has something like that. And in fact, there's even, even other Higgses, not even just the lightest Higgs, but the heavier Higgs can go to BB bar. And what we've done is used their technique with some modifications necessary to work in the supersymmetric environment to demonstrate that you can do the same thing with the SUSY Higgs, the only difference being that whereas this was standard model production to give rise to this peak, specifically, and you can kind of read off from the backgrounds here that it was Higgs vector boson, Higgs Strelung off vector boson fusion. You don't know what that means. I'll tell you all about it in a moment. Down here, this is really Squark production cascading down, spitting off a Higgs. And you can get a peak that looks, like this. And this is 10 inverse femtobarns of data. So this actually could be the first discovery mode far before gamma gamma or tau tau could be found, if the Higgs is in this mass range, and if you can, and at least in the case of supersymmetry, if it actually does cascade down and spit off a Higgs. And I'll tell you the criteria for which that will go. So that's the punchline. I'm going to get the very last few slides will be showing you more of these plots and explaining it, and then many of the slides in between will be going through this technique. Okay.
So good talk.
Yeah, that's right. So that's it. Now you can go to sleep. All right. So I say we did this, and I should really emphasize we is a very strong we. The vast bulk of the work was by all of these guys, particularly Tuan and Adam, which is not to say that obviously Michael had significant involvement as well. But these guys have developed these techniques, run them on the, developed all of the tools and so forth and gone through. We have one paper on this already, which I'll tell you a little bit about that. Another one, which is the very soon seems to be dependent on me. So hopefully it comes out. And we have actually even other ideas on down the line that are coming. So it's a cool bit. Okay, so here's the outline. So I'll just remind you about Higgs in the standard model. Then I'll tell you about boosting, what I mean by boosting, jet substructure, what I mean by that, Higgs and SUSY, boosted Higgs SUSY, and then a summary. Sorry, the offerings is out of date now, but anyway. So here's the, we will move. So the only two slides I have about the LHC is this one, right? So it is colliding. Oh, wow, okay, it's hard to see, but this is sort of a, this is the, of course, the LHC in the background and the wonderful magnets, which we all know. Built to find the Higgs, hopefully more things, but at least that much. Oh, yeah, right, there we go. Oh, fantastic. Oh, hey, well, it's, I'll probably keep awake, but.
Should we try that?
All right, there we go. Here is one of the events. Okay, I'm joking. At the bottom, but it is amazing that it's finally running, even if only at 7 TeV. No more LHC, but that's the technique. This is not applied to Tevatron. If you those sort of comments, we can address later, and I can tell you about why it probably won't work there, but it would work at it is supposed to work at LHC. So the standard model is right. We've got this, right? We've got a Higgs doublet with three of its components, the complex scalar here, the real scalar there, three of its components already observed in the form of longitudinal components of the gauge bosons, and one of which, of course, we're still hoping to find. So we all know that this thing gives rise to masses of fermions in the standard model and gauge bosons through these types of diagrams. When I connect up the diagrams in terms of a loop, of course, I get electroweak effects, so indirect effects of the Higgs on the precision properties of W's and Z's, something Cliff was involved in many, many years ago, and I learned a lot from. And it gives rise to plots like this, which have more than just the diagrams that I showed before, but other things. And they tend to predict, you know, the Higgs is supposed to be relatively light, although there is debate over exactly, you know, which observables I'm supposed to include and which ones are not, and so forth. But the upshot of it is that the preference is that the Higgs is relatively light. Now, HDK, we also know, depends on its mass, which modes are dominating, but certainly I can just turn the diagrams around that I had before, Higgs to FF bar, or through some sort of interaction like this into WW or ZZ, or other things that could happen. You go and compute the branching ratios. This is a bit of an older plot, but I think it gets the gist across from HDK. The various decay modes of the Higgs for this range in mass, the range motivated by the electroweak data, but you know, you can extend it off. It looks very much the same as you keep going up in mass. If I focus in on the region of relatively light Higgs, that is above the bound from LEP 2, and up to about, say, 135 GeV, you see that the BB bar mode dominates. And then down here we have other modes falling off. Okay, so WW, glue, oh, other things here which I could read off, tau, and so forth. And, you know, photon, and on this plot, because it was cut off at a few 10 to the minus 3, even the photon-photon mode is not even shown. Okay, so that's how small it is. If you go and look at then the ATLAS or CMS TDRs, these are the Bibles to tell us how we're supposed to find the Higgs. I have the ATLAS one for 10 inverse femtobarns, the CMS one for 30. I couldn't find the 10 quickly, so I'll show you that. CMS is going to look better. That's somewhat anomalous due to the differing luminosities. In any case, here's what it looks like again for a similar range in mass. These are many of the different modes by which ATLAS is going to search for the Higgs and the significance that you can get. And you see that, you know, for many of these modes, the modes in which ZZ goes through, Z with one of them possibly off shell, or WW, or so forth, the significance is relatively high here. We're talking about, you know, several, 5, 8 or so, and combined many of the channels up, there should be no difficulty in discovering the Higgs for, say, masses above about 130 or so GeV.
What's
W0, W2? I presume this is whether they, well, so there's a, I guess there's a couple of things. So one of these modes can come from VBF, vector boson fusion, where, right, you go, so that's one, this is one possibility. I have a feeling this has to do with just the specific search strategies that they're doing, and that they can, if they allow themselves to add in jets, they can get additional sensitivity to this. You see that actually most of this green is actually when they don't do that. That's
zero J.
Zero J. Oh yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Zero J means zero jets. Two jets. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. Very good. Yeah.
Is CMS a bit better for gamma low?
You'll see in a second.
Okay.
Let me just zoom in, though, because I'm largely not focused on any of the plot other than this range. So the range between about 115 to 130 or so. And I just zoomed in the previous plot, so I haven't, you know, mucked around with it. And here's what we see. So we see that the ZZ falling fast, the WW modes also falling fast, And somewhere, you know, right once you get below about 125, the only modes that are viable and the level of significance of each individual mode only being of order a few, right, the signal over square root background only of order a few, is for tau tau and for gamma gamma, right, two relatively rare modes. The CMS plot, it's a bit older, 2006, hence the larger 30 femtobarns. All this is also 14 TeV, of course. This is a big mess. Zooming in. And now you go to this issue of the photon-photon mode. There is something which I didn't study and I didn't get into because it's not of concern to me, but is this issue of whether you can do photon-photon better or worse with various levels of optimistic cuts or not. Yeah, so I think opt means optimistic. I think. But if it means optical, all right, so the video, someone can edit that out. But the upshot of it is, again, if I look at these modes, I see that the ZZ is falling quickly, right, as it goes down to low energies, and instead, and again, this is scaled, right, to 30 inverse femtobarns. That's been removed from the plot, so that's why all the numbers look higher. But the big modes, right, gamma gamma here, either this line or that line, and then the tau tau down here is the circles. Okay, so these are the modes that people are interested in for light Higgses. So the summary is that for masses roughly in this range, these are the two modes by which the standard model Higgs is currently being searched for. One which is 10 to the minus 3 and sensitive to loop corrections, other things that could be in the loop, and tau tau, which is sensitive to, of course, a small u power, as we all know. All right, so 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 2. The BB bar mode was essentially thought to be lost in the background, and so there was no way to extract it out, and that's the lower. So that goes to then this concept of boosting and jet substructure. And so that's what I want to talk about. And I'm going to go through little diagrams to give you some feeling for how this works. Yeah. Okay, so the common lore, at least for me, was that you collide two protons, you get, say, a QQ bar out. And then when you look at this in some highly simplified theorist version of a detector, which is my grid, It ends up giving you a splash in the hadronic calorimeter that is something, you know, okay, this is my crude thing, right? Something like that. And that the lore is that when you have a QQ bar, you get one hard parton per jet, right? This is the long-standing way of generally thinking about physics. So looking at this in more detail, obviously it's not that simple, as we know. There's at least some complications. Quarks radiate gluons relatively easily, right, through the parton shower, so that spits off more stuff. So it's not just the energy of the single hard parton, but there is this parton shower, which are themselves also relatively hard partons when you look at it. So they give various splashes in the detector along this line. So then when you have something like this, you have to think about, well, how am I supposed to characterize the jet, specifically the jet energy? If you want to characterize the jet energy well, you want to somehow capture all of this energy, right? You want to capture the parton shower as well as whatever, I mean, what I'm calling a hard parton here, but obviously it's reduced in its energy as well. You might think about, you know, doing something like this where you enlarge your cone size, trying to, you know, fill in as much of the stuff as you can. And this will more accurately give you a measure of the jet energy. The problem with this is that the larger the cone you make, the much more rapidly sensitive you get to these orange blobs, which are actually, I guess they're orange on my screen too. Yeah, anyway, or red blobs. Does this look red or orange to you? Depends on where you're colorblind, I guess, but okay. Red or orange, these colored blobs are meant to be, again, my theorist depiction of what I call underlying event. So underlying event can be the additional crap that comes off when you collide two protons. And obviously you have two hard partons, but you've got a lot of other junk that's there. It spits off and it has nothing to do with the hard interaction. So if you start including these bits inside some jet cone, you will again mismeasure the jet energy because you've added all of these bits up. This actually scales as roughly R to the fourth power. So as I, R meaning R the delta phi, delta eta squared, square root, you know, the invariant angular measure of a jet size, it scales as r to the fourth. So as I increase the jet radius, I really rapidly get sensitive to this, okay, the so-called underlying event. Now, if I think about partons that have a high PT that are boosted, then, for example, the process that led BDRS to be able to say that you can recover the BB bar mode was along this line. So they said, okay, we have PP bar. You go through, so you go PP bar, you, and it goes through Higgs Stirling. So you have Higgs, and then the Higgs goes to, I mean, in a Feynman diagram sense, it goes to a Higgs, and then it goes to, excuse me, a Z boson, and then the Z goes to another Z and a Higgs. I guess I should call them Zs here. Anyway, it's taken me a while to finally convert to Zs, but I've pretty much done it. Anyway, Zs or Zs that then go to leptons. So this is the ability to tag the event to say that it's going to be recorded by the trigger, and so you can look at it on tape. And then you get the Higgs, which will decay to partons, the BB bar, you know, but for the time being, just think about it as QQ bar. And now you're going to have these partons go off into the detector with two splashes that are much closer to each other, at least to the extent that it's boosted. So if I look more carefully at what happens to, say, a Higgs decay, so here's, you know, imagine this is a Higgs, imagine this is BB bar, doesn't really matter whether it's Bs or not. If it's boosted, then this means that the Higgs has high PT, it decays, and then these hard partons are collimated, and so is the parton shower. Right? So all of this showers in, and I get these large deposits of energy and these smaller bits and so forth from whatever the parton shower is giving me. And now my previous cone that I thought that I could capture the radiation with is now somehow also bringing in bits of the other parton here, so that the sense of trying to look for Higgs to BB bar as two separate Bs, a B and a B bar, is very hard when it's boosted. So generally, this is thought to be a bad situation to be in the LHC, because how do you separate two close splashes of hadronic energy? So the idea is, well, you could say, okay, I could handle that. I could enlarge the jet size and just do something like this. But again, I come back and I have, I could just do that. It has one obvious advantage. When you go to boosted jets, the energy resolution actually gets better and better as you go to higher and higher energies. So the raw energy resolution of the calorimeter does this, and you can...
That's with one jet.
That is with one jet, but that would, but yeah, it is with one jet, but this, basically the same thing works even if I go to, you know, some boosted blob, because the whole idea is just simply that the more energy that I've got deposited, then the better the resolution I have. So you know, to the boosted, more energy, life is better. But again, I suffer because of the wonderful underlying event. So if I thought that I could capture Higgs to BB bar in one large fat jet, if you like, one big fat thing like this, then I'm really sensitive to the underlying event, and so I would not have at all a particularly good way of extracting out the partons I really want from the crap that I don't.
Right. But if it's really high PT, like what else would you have in the underlying event? I mean, say for this particular process, like what else do you have if it's very...
Well,
besides just two Bs.
That depends. Well, again, that depends on modeling the underlying event, which is its own issue.
But you're not talking about like soft stuff.
Soft stuff, yeah, soft stuff. Relatively soft stuff. I mean, but soft stuff.
But you add enough of it up.
But adding enough of it up in a large cone.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if scaling is r to the fourth means that I try to enlarge the cone from a 0.4, 0.7, or say to something like. The original analysis for BDRS was to start with a cone of 1.5.
So can I think of it like pileup or something?
Pileup specifically can lead to this problem, that's all part of underlying event. Yeah. Pileup in this, I always get these things confused, pileup and multiple interactions, because they're always intuitively opposite to what I think they mean. But anyway, but you know what I mean? Like there is this stuff, and this is the
adding up so much of it that
right.
It can contribute. true.
Right. So it just means that then the probability that you can extract out the actual true, say, mass of this object from this stuff gets very diluted by the stuff that appears in the event. And that's the problem that you start with. So these guys, BDRS, Butterworth, Davison, Rubin, and Salam, in this paper, proposed a technique that involved basically, as you can guess from my diagrams, looking inside the jet, so-called jet substructure, and trying to pick out the pieces that are most likely to have come from the BB bar. And there's a combination of things, and there are several variations on a theme. There are other people who have looked for three-body decays, boosted tops. There are other techniques aside from filtering, pruning, and so forth. I'm not going to go into any of the other techniques. That's sort of beyond the scope of this talk. But I will explain, at least broadly speaking, how the jet substructure and the filtering works to try to extract this mode and then how they got their results. So that's the first half of the talk, right? The first half the prelude. What did I call it? The punchline. There we go. Okay. Their basic premise was, well, they want a boosted object, and they want a boosted object. The gain, the reason that this boosted is actually going to help you, is that it gives you some control on signal over background, because objects that are QCD oriented don't necessarily have the same properties of fat jets that a Higgs decay to BB bar would have. And you can try to exploit those differences in a way to dramatically reduce the background. That was sort of the key insight that they put into this. Now, of course, if you want an object that's boosted, if you want some initially a fat object with some substructure to it, you've got to at least get high PT on that. And at least for the standard model, if you do Higgs Drolong off Z or W, only some rare fraction of the time, say 5% of the time, is the PT large enough where then you can actually begin to see stuff within some larger cone and can group it together. So you have this is the interplay between the gain over getting uniqueness over QCD versus the loss over taking only a fraction of the events for the standard model. All right, there's a bunch of details about what they actually did. I'm going to explain almost all of this stuff. So let me just go straight to that. So start with a jet that's, say, some larger cone fat jet. Maybe it's B-tagged, maybe it's not, but it looks something like this. So here's my jet, and it has some mass, and the way in which, and again, these are things that are determined direct. You can either determine them directly from the jet reconstruction algorithms that they do directly from the calorimeter cells, or you can do it in other ways if you go right from the partons and then reconstruct from there. There's several ways you can see this. So you have a jet, it's got some PT, and it has some jet mass. I do a decomposition. The decomposition that they were thinking was in was called angular ordered jet reconstruction or deconstruction. In this case, I'm going to deconstruct it, but in practice, the jets were formed from starting from these little modules and then building them up through angular ordering, the so-called Cambridge-Aachen algorithm. Again, details of the algorithm not super important here, other than to say that it's infrared safe, and it's one of these wonderful algorithms that is implemented in the detector collaborations efforts. Okay, so if I do a decomposition of a jet, the way Cambridge-Aachen works is that each jet is formed from two subjets, always two, right, that had some other PT that came from, say, something like this. All right, so I have what was previously what I thought was one parton is actually resolved as two and two blobs. And each of these has their own jet mass. And at least with respect to the Cambridge-Aachen reconstruction algorithm, you can track all of this through and see that you start with, you know, jet one with mass one, and then the subjets with their masses. And you can just keep on going. You keep on unclustering. Say, if this was really from, say, a BB bar, I might think that I'm sort of coloring these as BB bar to guide your eye. But in practice, I've got this, and I've got parton shower stuff, and I'm not even showing underlying event stuff that's actually within the jet cone. And you can just sort of keep on going, getting jet masses as you go. their way of trying to reconstruct a Higgs from a fat jet was to proceed as follows. So they say, step one, when they decompose one of these jets into subjets, they look for what they call a mass drop, which means that the jet mass of the highest jet mass of one of the subjects is less than some fraction times the jet mass that you started with. Now, it's deterministically in this range, but the idea that it would drop significantly is related to the idea of having a massive particle that decayed into nearly massless partons. Higgs to BB bar is an example of that, right? And if that happens, then you expect the jet masses to drop significantly from one to another. That's first requirement. Second requirement was that they were after what they called asymmetry, which is simply a parameter that you can construct out of the PT and the delta R between the two jets. So they, what it actually is looking at the minimum PT over the jet mass squared weighted by delta R being larger than some critical value. And this at first may seem a little bit odd. If I actually sort of put the values in, there we go. The cut is of order, well, the number that they actually use is 0.3. You can actually move this number around to see how things change. The upshot of this asymmetric cut is that it tends to reject soft collinear QCD contamination, that which then, say, the PT for one of these things is small. So either it's small relative to the jet mass, and then the delta R is whatever it is, so then one jet versus another jet, one will look like, you know, soft QCD contamination. Versus, on the other hand, if this ratio is large, but then the delta R is particularly large, then it's far away from this structure. So you again can sort of reject it based on that. So this was the step to try to ensure that essentially you really have BB bar. They're well separated, not super close together, and thereby try to reject QCD contamination. And this guy looking for heavy particle decay. Now, the second thing you can do though is look at, once you satisfy these conditions that you have a mass drop and you have this asymmetric parameter is satisfied, so that it doesn't look like soft QCD contamination. You can then ask, are these subjects themselves B-tagged? Now, how you treat B-tagging is something that depends on whether you're an experimentalist or a theorist and so forth. But there is at least a well-defined way from an experimental point of view. They have actually many different ways by which they can try to B-tag jets. You can ask and force that then these two guys are B-tagged. They don't B-tag everything, right? So B-tags are not 100%. Typically, their ranges is between sort of 50-60% or so is what the, and it may be up to 70 depending on in certain circumstances.
I mean, does it yep. when they're very collimated, is it trickier or easier?
It would be, but again, because I'm going to force some. Oops, I went the wrong way. Because I'm going to force this sort of, you know, this asymmetric thing here. This y can almost think of as very much like the delta R between the two jets. So even if I take, so suppose I take the PTs of these to be comparable, this is an order one number. So then what this is basically saying is I require that the delta R between the two subjects is larger than 0.3. Okay, so that's sort of that's gonna set the limit in which they get too close together will be cut off by that. That will throw out some signal, but at the same time, it will reject this faster, and that's the basic goal. Okay, so whether they're B-tag. And then if they are, great. We have the potential for then a fat jet that came from a Higgs, a boosted Higgs going to BB bar, and this looks great. The last step is, now that we've identified one of the objects, can we clean it up to figure out what pieces, what subjects within this fat jet are actually coming from BB bar itself, so as to try to get a candidate jet mass that most accurately represents the underlying hard process, the Higgs decay itself. And that was the idea of what's called filtering. And filtering, there are several different variations on a theme for how you could filter jets. Their way of doing it was to do the following. You redo the clustering, but now with an angular size that is the minimum of the distance between the two B-tag subjects, or some minimum, in this case is 0.3. So again, this 0.3 comes back to haunt you. So it's roughly speaking, I might look at some deconstructed set of subjects like this. I have two B-tagged, there's my RB, I do a reconstruction. And then what I do is the way that BDRS did this was that they took not just the BB bar, but actually the top three highest PT jets, summed those up, and that gave you the Higgs candidate jet mass. The reason for three and not two is to try to capture the leading order QCD radiation. So obviously some of the time you're going to be wrong here, but more of the time you're going to be right. And from that point of view, you can more accurately try to represent this. You can actually do this with two or three and then compare the differences, and you find, at least in simulation point of view, that it's better to do three. You tend to get a better jet mass. With this result, what you've got is you've basically got then events with one number that you want to plot, right, which is the jet mass of this object that you've extracted out of the data. And if this thing, there we go. And that's what this plot is. Okay, so the punchline, the first half of the punchline was this plot. The mass that they were plotting down here was the mass constructed by taking one of these fat jets, decomposing it, filtering it, reconstructing from the underlying partons, and they get blots. And they do this for background as well as for signal. They are getting, I think in all of this, if you look carefully, it's hard to see from this angle, but they're getting what should be a Z peak here, the green. They're getting what is actually the Higgs peak there. But this is on top of a background, and then, you know, life is good. The way they did this was, of course, with some B-tagging, some mistagging rate, which is something that often happens, right? A jet goes off and it gets mistagged as a B. This happens some fraction of the time. You have to incorporate some model of the underlying event, of which they did. The key thing to all of this, which is something you have to check in practice with specific detector simulations, is what happens when you smear energies out. Okay, so this is the result with no smearing. When you then take this result and you look at how well they can do in terms of significance, you see that, okay, so here's the range between the left bound up to, you know, 125 or so, and you see that they can get significances that range between, say, about 3 to 6, depending on the R's that they start, the cone radii, as well as the various B tagging efficiencies and the mistagging efficiencies. So obviously, in practice, this has to be done by the detector collaborations. They have to figure out how well they can do, okay, to determine, you know, how well you can do on this plot. But the basic idea, though, is you can get significances, you know, in the neighborhood of 3, 4, 5, depending on which parameters you take and depending on what masses you're looking at here, but at least within this range where tau tau and gamma gamma were previously the only modes you could be sensitive to.
And the left column, like this 200, 300 G, what is this? Was like average energy?
The left column. This column here. Oh, this is the PT. Yeah, that's the PT cut that they put on the partons. Yep. Okay, so they played around with this to see how well they thought they could do, and obviously there's another measure of how you extract the significance, and how well you know the background. So this is a process that the detectors have to go off and do, which they did about 6 months ago. Well, now I guess maybe 10 months ago, 9 months ago. In this publication that appeared in August, they went off and looked at the same thing, and they actually added in some backgrounds on top of this, including top. And their idea was to, again, try to see how well they could extract out a peak different from the Z peak that could represent from a Higgs. This is one of their plots, and what you're supposed to see on this is the blue bump on top of the background, on top of a falling background, you know, where here is my wonderful Z peak. And don't ask me what the one on the right is. Wait, I'm supposed to be able to tell what the one on the right is. Oh yeah, well, okay, here, I don't know. Sorry, I don't know what the difference is between the left and the right now. I think it's I see. No, sorry. I think it's one on the left or on the right has to do with exactly what set of events they were looking at to tag the Higgs. Whether they were looking at, say, something where the Z goes to two leptons, or whether you go from WW and a W would go to a single lepton. So I think this has to do with basically the W mode or the Z mode, if I remember correctly. And they broke it down in terms of the two pieces, whereas what I showed you before was a combined analysis of both WW and ZZ. There are caveats to this. I extracted this directly from their paper. And they say, from the cut-based analysis, combined sensitivity of the channels, combined meaning the Higgs Strelung off W's or the Higgs Strelung off Z, the combined sensitivity of these channels after an integrated luminosity of 30 universal yards is 3.7 sigma. So the numbers that you were seeing before was more like 4 to 5 or so. Actually, the actual number, when you use 120 GeV and you use the specific thing that they did here, the theory number from BDRS was 4.2 for significance, and here it's like 3.7. So it goes down a bit, to be sure. Smearing and some of these effects have an impact. But 3.7 is significant on the level of that significance plot that I had before at the low masses, right? And that's the whole point. So this mode alone will significantly add to the sensitivity of Higgs at very low masses, the sub-125 GeV. There are caveats, the caveats having to do with systematic uncertainties on the backgrounds. Yep, that's there. So that's something that will have to be dealt with as the detectors go forward. Okay, so that's the situation as of, 8 months ago. So new mode, BB bar can be recovered, jet substructure, BDRS did it first. Several other people have played games with this now and done other things. Using the technique of jet substructure, been cross-checked in ATLAS. I don't know where CMS is with this, but I think they are also doing some analysis of this as well. I actually don't remember off the top of my head now. Someone did tell me the details of this, and I'm not remembering it. But they're both obviously very interested in trying to construct this. But the key thing to all of this was, though, that this only works. And that's really not a big deal, but it only works between, say, 115 to 125 in range and mass, which if you look at that electroweak plot that I had from the beginning, right, okay, sure, you might favor a lighter mass, but 125 and 140 is just about as equivalent, okay, because the sensitivity is only log to the Higgs mass, right, from the electroweak precision data. But when you go to supersymmetry, I stole this from just searching on Google, and when I stole it from Google, of course, they had Higgs and then Higgsino. And they kind of forgot the fact that, you have to add in two doublets here. But anyway, okay, this is what I get for going to Google Images. In any case, supersymmetry is even more promising for reasons which many of you may be already immediately familiar. But let me just walk you through it. The key difference, right, between supersymmetry and the standard model is that the quartic coupling is determined. So that means that this coupling, which was previously a free parameter in the standard model, is determined to be g squared plus g prime squared in supersymmetry because this comes from a d term. The d terms are determined. Right? Now, when I say determined, it's determined at tree level. Right? Determined at tree level, there are also loop corrections. In fact, if there were no loop corrections, then you could determine the Higgs mass from this because it comes derived from the quartic coupling, and the Higgs mass would have been mz in the limit of large tan beta. That which has now long since been ruled out. Okay, so fortunately, there are loop corrections, and the loop corrections scale as, I didn't put the 16 pi squared in here, but they scale as the top quark you cow it to the fourth power. And there are both the fermions running in this loop and the scalars, and it's the incomplete cancellation of this that is saving the model from dying. When you do this in detail, here's one version of the Higgs mass plot from these folks in 2002. The Higgs mass prediction varies between, 105, 110 or so, up to maybe 125. This isn't even hitting 130 GeV for, I think it may not even be written on here, but they took, the M SUSY meaning the masses of the stops to be 1 TeV, some value of the mu parameter, and XT, which is related to the scalar trilinear coupling. It's actually the sum of a bunch of things, but basically the off-diagonal element in the stop mass matrix And this is in units of TeV. So for example, if you restrict to all SUSY breaking parameters sub TeV, you're basically in sort of this range here, and you would then see that the Higgs mass is sub 120 or so TeV. And again, you can play around with this. There's two loop corrections, there's blah, blah, blah. But the upshot of it is that generally speaking, the Higgs is very, very near the left bound. And the only way it's far beyond that, it's say, the only way it's far beyond, I'd say 125 or 130, is if the superpartner masses are so heavy, right, that you're not going to see them at the LHC.
If I decouple squirt, the Higgs mass goes back to the MC.
You mean this.
There is a logarithmic correction of one M stop, but
right.
If I make M stop for hundreds of TeVs, it actually, as far as I remember, it goes back to the to MC.
No, not necessarily, because if I decouple that, then I'm really going into a model. I mean, at some level, I'm going back to the model of the standard model.
No, but you're going back to the SUSY model. Are you trying to say that you renormalize the port couplings in big time?
Well, certainly at the point, by the time I integrate out stops, then I've got a quartic that's just going to run as in the standard model to leading order. So now you're asking me, how does the quartic run in the presence of all of these things? Okay, so we have to.
I'm just interested. You have a log, right? So
yeah.
You can make a log arbitrarily large. Is that interesting?
You can.
I think at some point you have to resum the one loop.
Right, but. But this coupling is only determined at the scale, really at the scale where you integrate out the stops. Right, and then below that, it's running a standard model. So, anyway, but okay.
But you have a sort of SUSY input for initial input.
Yeah, but that's lost once you integrate out the stops. Then you're in standard model trajectory. Anyway, we can. Not going to impact what I'm going to say, because at the end of it, all I'm interested in is the point that. Generally speaking, the Higgs is light in the standard model, in the supersymmetric standard model, all right? And even if you have some more elaborate model with heavier squarks, what I will say will apply to the range when it's between, 110 or so up to 125.
Well, you understand my question. If the stop mass is not fixed, why can't I make it, I don't know?
You can.
Hundreds of TeV.
You can, but then it's just unnatural.
Would your Higgs stay below 130, or would you go above? As far as I remember, it would stay below 130, even if you start playing crazy things with this stuff.
Well, again, because it's only log sensitive. But
no. You resum the logs, and then they would. It comes back in some sense. Maybe it's some scheme.
No, but the picture would be, right, you come down to a scale, I integrate out the stops, then I'm in effectively a non-supersymmetric model, right? I'm in
with a specific coupling there,
yeah? And so now what you're forcing me to think about is, how does the quartic coupling run in the standard model, right, as I go down, and I have, and the...
It's got to be the stop mass. If the stop mass is very heavy, the Higgs got to be pushed up to the stop mass. That's a hierarchy problem. Right?
It's then you're saying that there's a quadratic sensitivity to M stop.
Yes.
Why is it 130 then? Then you can have 200, 300, right?
No, you can't, right? Because if it were 300, then the quartic would blow up.
Shouldn't that be how it is?
Right?
Pardon?
Shouldn't that be how it is? That's not how it is.
No, it's not how it is. No, not at all.
But then why is there any hierarchy problem? I can take SUSY breaking to whatever, and then there's no hierarchy problem. But even though it has to be that if I take M soft heavy, then
so you having contradiction. He's saying it's a lot.
This is not worth it.
It's some different. He's saying because you're gonna fix the quadratic because you know what the G fermion is, right? So the free parameter in the model used to be. Think of it being the quartic coupling, and I think Maxine, you're saying that it's not to do with the running of that. You're just saying you're coming in with an input that it was some small value because it was tied to the gauge coupling.
Mm-hmm.
And if the threshold effects there were large, then they would be large anywhere, and you would have had a rating for the mass. That sounds reasonable to me, doesn't it? Yeah.
Let's discuss it afterward. I don't want to.
Then you should explain why 130 seem to be a total, you know, an upper bound for the Higgs mass. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. If you range for all parameter values and you find an upper
even
bound,
even if you have a log dependence,
yes,
right, I can take a crazy value for my stop and my log surely will be large.
Right? Yeah. Right. Sure.
And so then in that picture, what you're thinking, there are no limits on the Higgs mass. So continue increasing logarithmically with the mass of the stop being decoupled.
Sure. 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 Yeah,
that's
no, no,
wrong. That's not
sure.
At some point, you have to resum the
sure. 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 Sure.
To the Suzy value of some sort.
But you agree that the picture is well defined in the following sense, right? I come down the scale, I integrate out the stops, I'm in standard model territory below that, and then I just evolve and I get whatever I get.
Yeah, of course. But you have an input for the standard model.
I have an input for the standard model. Yeah, I have an input for the standard model. Yeah, I agree. That's right. But we do know one thing, right? We know that as I raise the stops marginally, right, then
yeah, I was just asking where the log behavior stops, because I do think that it will stop at some point.
Yes. So it will.
Otherwise,
right.
People would pull it to, you know, like a reasonable, I mean, the range for the Higgs.
Right, but that's also under the general assumption that super partners are visible, right?
No, I don't think that's
what they usually assume, because otherwise you don't solve the
right.
I think this is much more with less assumptions.
Let's. This is not relevant to this point. Okay, here we go. So let me back up. Okay, sorry. Let me back up a second. So the at least with respect to certain sets of parameters within the measure by which you can find at LHC, the Higgs mass sits within a certain range, and that's well defined. You're not gonna pin me. You're not gonna. Play with that. Now, whether it can be heavier or not, that's we can debate that point afterward. All right. Within this range, then the key thing in this way of thinking is that what was previously so. I mean, usually the way you think about superpartners and the way you think about the interactions, the Higgses, because they come along with Higgsinos, which are essentially just vector-like. Fermions that I've added to the standard model so as to cancel the anomaly that would have arose if I had had only one doublet of one type, up type or down type, I really have what are, you can think of as standard model interactions of the Higgsinos, which is just the gauge bosons coupling to the fermions, fermions that behave very much like lepton doublets, right? So I've got gauge boson, say the hypercharge or the W's interacting with the Higgsinos with strength G or G prime, depending on which one I'm talking about. When I supersymmetrize that interaction, and this is a little bit odd, it may look a little odd at first because, wait, isn't this a superpartner? But really you should think no. Okay, you should think this is just some Higgsino, it is whatever it is. And this is the starting interaction. I supersymmetrize it, and I get a Higgsino, Bino or Wino, and Higgs with a strength G or G prime. Right? And this is the supersymmetric analog of that interaction on the left. This means that Higgsinos can decay to the Higgs, and they can decay to them with rates that are far larger than you would ordinarily expect, or at least naively expect. So if I think about a Bino or a Wino, if it is kinematically open for a Bino or Wino to decay into a Higgsino, the fermion, and the Higgs, this is going to go proportional to G or G prime, depending on which gauge boson I'm dealing with, and on average, I can treat this whole thing as basically a doublet of fermions, and then I've got a doublet of scalars down here. And the doublet of scalars is really all of the scalars that we were really talking about, right? The Higgs, the Z, the longitudinal component of the Z and of the W, right? So all of the components. So this means that, roughly speaking, a quarter of the time when you talk about the decay of a beano or a weino, you're going to get out a Higgs, and then the other fraction of the time you'll get one of these longitudinal components, which of course becomes a real physical gauge boson in the standard model, right? The real physical Z or the W. So with a non-trivial fraction of the time, if you have a hierarchy between the beano and the Higgsino, you can get a Higgs. The hierarchy you need is what? Well, okay, so the bound on the Higgsinos because of the charged guys is from lep 2 is borderline, you know, roughly 100 GeV or so. Maybe a bit larger if you incorporate Tevatron bounds. If I add in a Higgs mass of, you know, on this ballpark, then what I'm talking about is beanos or weanos that are larger than about this number. And that's all you need. You need Higgsino lightest, beano or weano above about this number, and this decay will go. There's another way it can go as well, which is that Higgsinos could decay straight to the Higgs. Higgsinos could go straight to a Higgs and say a gravitino in certain instances where, you know, the gravitino is lighter than all of the other particles and say this is the NLSP. Okay. Both of these cases, again, there's some kinematical requirement, but otherwise the decays can go through. Let me focus on sort of the first case for sort of the remainder of the discussion. I think I have one plot of the second case. So when I think about squark production, here's what usually happens, right? You produce squarks from just gluon, right? S-channel gluons. I go to squarks. I can go to all different types of squarks, the first, second generation. I can go to left or right squarks. If I go to the left-handed squarks, they invariably go to the weano straight, right? And if I produce the first two generations of squarks, they never go to the Higgs straight because they never skip this step because, of course, they have tiny Yukawa couplings. So they always go to the Higgsino first, 97% of the time, by the way, in some of the points we're doing. Okay, they always go to the Higgsino first and then decay down to, and then this beano or weano will then decay to the Higgsino and the Higgs, okay, with some squark out of this. These cross-sections can be large, right? For one TeV squarks, this can be several picobarns, right? So a large cross-section we're talking. Obviously, the cross-section drops quickly as, you know, you raise the squarks 2-3 TeV and so forth. Okay. Now, oops. I skipped one. Sorry. Here we go. So this mode being always present in the situation where I'm imagining, because I'm taking specific points with superpartners TeV and below. So the Higgs is always light. It always goes to BB bar the vast majority of the time. You have these new production sources, but then you get one additional benefit to the whole boosted analysis, which is that, of course, you start with squarks. They decay to some weanos, then they decay to Higgsino, and in this cascade process, the Higgs is, on average, always boosted. In fact, you find typically you can get 50, 60, 70% of the time the Higgs is boosted. Boosted, in this case, meaning boosted beyond the level necessary to use the jet substructure techniques. So that's what we realized, and that's what we did with this. The problem with SUSY production is that you have these squarks, and in some instances you have other stuff in your event, depending on where this came from, whether this was squark production to begin with, or whether I had a gluino first that went to a squark and a quark and so forth. I can have many other quarks in the event, and these hard partons can fake Bs, right? They can fake Bs if they happen to go into the jet direction. B tagging efficiency is only 50, 60%, so the fraction of time that this happens is non-trivial. You know? So you have to worry about any time you have other partons, so not the clean process of Z and then Higgs, but you have something more complicated, you have to worry about this contamination, real hard parton contamination. Actually, these guys, our collaborator, Michael Spinovsky, and Michael and Gavin Salem and Tillman Plain did a study of TT bar Higgs, another mode that was taken for dead some years ago, a couple of years ago, and they revived, albeit with a large amount of integrated luminosity on the order of 100 inverse femtobarns, so that you can try to come and actually measure this thing. But anyway, they had the same problem, and we sort of cross-pollinated, I would say, to uncover techniques to try to extract this. The technique we used was called sort of similarity. And what this means is that we follow a procedure similar to what BDRS did. We still have the mass drop. We still have the asymmetric cut. Okay, we still do B-tagging of the subjects. But now what you do is you, at each stage of declustering, you compute this measure called similarity, which looks awfully like the asymmetric parameter I had before. But then at the stage where you do this declustering, you compute the similarity, and then you look for the stage which has the maximum similarity. And when we do this, we find we can mildly, not significantly, but we can mildly enhance the number of events. We can mildly enhance getting the right candidate jet mass so as to narrow the peak, right? The peak that we want to use to be able to find the Higgs in the first place. Yeah, so again, proceed the same way, three hardest PT jets and so forth. The similarity, though, has the advantage that it tends to reject the SUSY backgrounds from either extra hard Bs or extra jets that then fake Bs going into the event. Let me give you an example then of how well we did. So this is a plot that we published in the December paper. The December paper, we focused on the easiest case, which was the Higgsino NLSP going to a Higgs and a Gravitino. We did that case because if this technique was going to work at all, it had better work here first. So we figured we'd do what we thought was the case that was going to work easiest first and then move on. And, well, this is the spectrum of the particles, Higgsino, Bino, Wino, TEV, Squarks, various relatively mild cuts. Given this decay, the Higgsino going to Higgs and Gravitino, you also get about, the rates are down here, roughly 50% of the time, the Higgsino will go to a photon, not because the Higgsino so much couples to the photon, but because there's some, there's some Bino content. And so occasionally this can go through. So you can actually use the photon to tag these events. And that's an easy way to be able to cleanly identify the events separated from background. That will work for this particular instance. And what you find is you get a wonderful Higgs peak there. You also see, some number of events from Z, from what I believe are top shifted down slightly, and so forth. And then there's a background, and there's a funny structure to the background here, but you'll see that the background changes depending on what process that I've done. Now, there are details. We'll not get into it. Go to the neutralino LSP case. So now this is a case where I'm really doing this decay of Squark to, say, Wino to Higgsino, and the Higgsino itself is the LSP. If I look at the boosted fraction, again, depending on the ratio of the Bino to Wino mass, or to the Higgsino mass, this was holding the Wino also fixed in some ratio to the Bino, you get, again, generally high fractions of time that these things are boosted, and the different curves do correspond to whether I put a cut of 200 or 300 GeV. Yeah, so this is the percentage of time that it's boosted. I should have written that. So it's 30% up to, and then up to 100. So, yep. Go ahead.
Actually, I have a question to the previous slide. So, is there a complication because the
this slide?
Yes, because the NLSP will only decay after some certain wavelength.
Yeah. We took this to these to decay promptly. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So all of
it. It is a very light rotation.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, if it's not prompt, then you have the ability to find this. Well, then you have two possibilities, right? Either this morphs back into the situation I'm about to discuss, which is a Higgsino LSP, which from a collider point of view is exactly what happens here if the Gravitino is heavy, right? And the decay length, or the decay time is long. Or you get the intermediate regime, in which case then you have even more spectacular signals to see at the LHC. Okay, so it depends. Yeah, it's the situation can only improve if you happen to sit in the middle. But if you sit in the limit, which is large, then you morph over to essentially this scenario, right, where the Higgsino is the NLSP. The Higgsino is the equivalent, the collider equivalent LSP. Yeah. So then we did this, and we did this, and here's another one of these plots, which shows again background on the bottom, the Higgs peak right in the middle. Various fairly stringent cuts were put on this to try to reduce the background down. High missing energy, high HT, the total transverse energy within the event, and also a lepton veto to remove out top, because top is the largest background for this process. Top is amazing about how it can fake different things. Here's the hierarchy. So the situation is you produce quarks. They decay to either the Beano or the Higgsino, Beano or Higgsino, and then they decay down to the Beano or the Weino, Beano or Weino, then goes down to the Higgsino and spits off a Higgs, and then you reconstruct it in this way. A different point. Now take the pseudoscalar mass from a TeV down to 200 GeV. You still see the Higgs peak with no problem. You also now see the pseudoscalar, or the A, or the H naught, the other Higgs, coming up with a bump. Okay. We find that it has to be sort of sub 200, 225 or so to be able to see the bump. It rapidly gets pretty small as you go up. And with this heavy mass, you need a fair splitting between, say, the Beano down to the Higgsino to be able to split this thing off. Okay. But the fraction of time that you can actually pick out that, as well as this, is non-trivial. We've also done studies where you go lower in mass to be able to see that this can happen as well, in cases where, say, the heavy Higgs actually looks more standard model-like. You can do this in a case where then if you worry about dark matter, relic density, and so forth, a Higgsino tends to have an underabundant density from the point of view of dark matter, because the Higgsinos annihilate a little too efficiently. But if you lower the Beano mass a little bit below the Higgsino, you can still get cascade decays where they go from the Squarks to the Weino down to the Higgsino, and then the lightest guy is a mixture between these two states, and you can see the Higgs peak, and there's also underneath all of this is the Z and so forth. In fact, you can actually go and sort of pick this apart if you want to. You can take, say, the plot, just the blue part of the plot here, which is the supersymmetric, quote-unquote, signal and background, and deconstruct it. And I know this plot is hard to see, the different contours, so I'll try to point to them. You can deconstruct that as which of these fat jets actually came from a Higgs in Monte Carlo truth, and this is sort of this blob that you see right here. Which of them came from a Z, and you see there's a little blob over here. So that's actually what's contributing to this excess shoulder. And you can look for, say, T or W or other things, and to see to the extent to which they also show up in time in the signal. So this is basically the upshot. I should emphasize these plots made 10 inverse femtobarns. So to the extent that the collider detector collaborations, the Atlas and CMS, could go off and do this stuff, you know, they could verify to see whether they can actually pull off, you know, background rejection to the level that we think that they can do, and be able to pull off these peaks. Right. So this is, and obviously, you know, compared to the peak that we had before, which from BDRS, which was, you know, significance of 3 or 4 for 30 inverse femtobarns of data, this has far, is beyond 5 significance in 10 inverse femtobarns. Okay. So
in this scenario, what is actually seen here? So is it some other Suzy signature?
Right. No, it's a good point. So you're going to see missing energy, large missing energy first. You're going to see missing energy in the usual channels, right? The jets plus blah, 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 blah. And as we all know, you're going to have no idea what it is, right? You don't know if it's UED or some this or that or blah, 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 right? So your interest then is to say, well, to what extent is the new physics connected to electroweak symmetry breaking? You do this analysis on these events, on essentially the new physics events, right, on the missing energy events. And if you find peak BB bar, you declare victory, at least with respect to saying that I have a, what this is experimentally, technically telling you is simply there is a resonance in BB bar consistent with a boosted object, right, going to a fat jet of this type, which is highly consistent with, of course, the light Higgs. That doesn't tell you it's the light Higgs. That requires more time. But this is, if I, you know, they go off and they see this thing. Gotta get cases of champagne and be happy. So that's it. That's the upshot. This is what we did, and this is where we're at. And we're actually very excited about this because the traditionally the way you search for Higgses in supersymmetry, the so-called famous MA tan beta plane, and you can look in this plane and blah blah blah. In fact, somewhere in the deep buried extra of the slides, oh yeah, here's a couple of these old plots. Here's the MA tan beta plane at Atlas going up to MA of 500. And all of these things in here are the complicated ways in which A or Higgs or little Higgs meaning the lightest Higgs, are going to different channels and the regions by which can be probed within all of this stuff. CMS had another study. This is a little bit more recent. This is quite old and has been updated, but I found this one first. And this one was relatively new. Also looking at different ways they can try to extract out the Higgs. Notice that they're also focusing on the photon-photon modes as well as the tau-tau modes for this masses, because that's the range that's relevant. But notice one other thing that's amusing about all of this. They have, as the parameters of the model for which they're doing their sort of canonical search for the Higgs, they have M Suzy 1 TeV. That was the same mass of Squarks that we had. They have the Higgsino of 200 GeV. That was actually the same Higgsino mass that we had taken. The only difference that we took from what they had is that we took the Wino mass instead of 200, meaning degenerate here, so that it obviously wouldn't decay down, and we took this to be 600. And you go from having to wait for 30 or 60 inverse femtobarns of data, down here you can see 30 to 60 inverse femtobarns of data to try to cover this, and within 10 inverse femtobarns you can find just the peak.
So in this particular point,
yep,
there's no Suzy decays in
Higgs. Right. Yeah. This, not in this way of the Beano the Wino to Higgsino.
But there could be other channels.
There can be. They then you have to dig it through. Right. So what I'm telling you is, ordinarily you see a peak like that and you say, what did I do to somehow get that peak? And what I'm telling you is, you have to do relatively very little to the spectrum. All you have to do is to have a hierarchy of Beano or Higgsino.
No, I guess my question is, Suzy, is it generic for, you produce colored stuff and through decay, cascade into Higgs? Is that a generic thing? That's all I'm asking.
It is generic to the extent that the cascades spit off the Higgs, and that depends on the mass hierarchy, the Higgsinos and Higgsino. So you can always
have a spectrum where you don't get that.
You can get a spectrum where you can highly suppress the Higgs. Yeah, yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. I'm not saying you get this in all parameter space. Yeah, that's right. So you want to, I'm not saying you don't do these studies. You obviously want to do this. But what I'm saying is, tiny change in the spectrum, and you could find this thing with level of five significance far before any of these guys claim that you could do it. Yeah. That's the power of this technique. Yeah. So let me summarize. Jet substructure techniques can find a boosted Higgs to BB Bohr. This is great for supersymmetry because it's automatically light and you can get a large rate from squirt production and cascade decay with the assumptions about the hierarchy that I gave you. Because it's coming from a decay and not from some boosted regime of a low energy cross section, a large fraction is boosted, which means that it's a large fraction of the time. This is exactly the analysis that you want to do to be able to see this thing. And then, I think what is sort of amazing to me is that with much smaller amount of data than what one ordinarily would have thought, you could potentially discover the Higgs and maybe even the heavier states, if they're light enough, with a small amount of data. Okay, that's it. Thank you. You're asking me to predict the operations of the LHC. Is that? The plan is to do one inverse femtobarn at 7 TeV center of mass, right, over a year and a half. Then they shut down and they start up again. So assuming they start up beyond 10 TeV, so you can produce this stuff, not with some reasonable cross sections. And then it's however long it takes them to do that, but it's, a couple of years. It's not too long. Yeah. 10 inverse femtobarns is not a high number. I mean, it's whenever you see a plot that has 600 inverse femtobarns, then you should be worried. But But a few years, I think. Remember I had this thing at the end, the dot, 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 and without a title? Yeah. 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 You can. Yeah. Yeah. There are even other things you can do that are probably even more interesting, and you can also then sort of directly connect them in, well, all right, so circumstantially connect them with the electroweak symmetry breaking of the new physics. I mean, in some ways, that's one of the things that's very interesting about doing a study of the new physics events itself, is that you're uncovering Higgs within the new physics. So, I mean, you could always imagine you've got some new crap and it decays down, it spits off dark matter, but it has nothing to do with electroweak symmetry breaking. Could be, right? A whole bunch of vector-like stuff that decays down, some stable vector-like whatever. Could be true. This way, you see a Higgs in the event sample, and then, or at least you see something that is consistent with Higgs going to BD bar and so forth, and you say, well, this is interesting. Again, it takes time, it takes, you know, to uncover that it's really a Higgs, it takes time to uncover all of the details and to sort it out, but this is what makes it, I think, fun. So we're very excited.
Other questions?
A question?